talked about degradation testing earlier in the test planning section. Here we'll talk about a little bit more detail about it and support it with my first technical paper written some years ago and add that into the mix so that you have some background on at least one application of it. And it was a fairly exotic statistical evaluation. I had a university professor as the co-author of the paper. He did all the heavy lifting with the analysis. I did all the sample prep and testing, though. So anyway, let's take a look at degradation testing. So I briefly explained this earlier, but I didn't really have a lot of room, so I'll cover it again here. So the idea of a failure threshold is defining failure is a product that, say, a light bulb that slowly dims. And at some point, it's not providing enough light that the customer and or the manufacturer would define it as a failure. So if this was lumens on the vertical axis, and as lumens degraded, at some point we would say it's crossed the line and it's a failure. I'm finding that if I tap the screen, I get it to escape out of the presentation mode, so apologize for that. So anyway, that's the basic idea. In the one test that I ran some years ago, let's see, get my pen back, was on LEDs. And they do have the, over time, the amount of light that they produce does degrade. So the light power, or the lumens that it provides, degrades or dims over time. And what happens, though, is that it gets brighter initially, say the first week or so, and then it slowly fades away. Now, we could put just to fit a straight line to this, and that's what most people would typically do. And so this is being run at, say, 60 degrees Celsius, and I get one slope. Where if I, let's see if I can find another color here, if I run it at a higher temperature, say 80 degrees Celsius, I get a steeper slope. And what I'm looking for is where they cross this failure threshold. And what I'll get is, given the number of samples I have, I'll get some distribution of when they cross that failure threshold. And the idea is to create a relationship between the stresses and the time to failure so that find a color I haven't used yet. Here we go. In use conditions, say at 30 C, I can then, this extrapolates out, I'll find the distribution that applies for time to failure at use conditions. And it's really just applying the chain, the relationship between stress and the time to failure information. The advantage is that every sample is going to give me a trajectory that I can map out to failure. I don't have to wait for all of them to cross that threshold. I can project, if they're well behaved, when they'll cross it earlier than expected. Now, with all that regression going on and all of that statistics going on, we typically need a good number of samples, say 30, 40, maybe 50 samples if possible or more, in order to make this work. But it does give us a pretty robust model between the stresses and the time to failure, which is also a lot fewer samples than other types of accelerated testing. And so it allows us to get a lot of information and run them all to failure, or the equivalent of failure, as we do the analysis. So it gives us a pretty good deal. And off of this threshold piece, we get these distributions that come through. Now, these can be normal or Weibull or log normal or whatever. And so there's a relationship between the different stresses that take us up to use conditions, and then there's a time to failure distribution. And so there's a couple, it's like the acceleration factors that we talked about earlier, acceleration models. There are some non-parametric models that allow us to explore the degradation or the performance roll-off as it goes over time. And it usually works with, you know, smaller sample sizes. It also works when we really don't know the distribution and We don't want to make assumptions about the distribution. You may find non-parametric models more prevalent in medical industry areas where they tend to be more conservative in running these kinds of tests. One of the models that's non-parametric is a linear model. We're basically assuming that the stresses each apply have their own relationship that's independent from the other stresses' contribution to the damage to a product. So I might have temperature, I might have humidity, I might have rate of use, different kinds of criteria that go into the stresses. But then each stress has its own slope term in this equation, or its own factor that suggests its contribution or proportional contribution to the overall accumulated damage. There's an error term, like in most any regression type of consideration. But the idea is that whether I have one stress or many stresses, this provides a simple model that allows us to evaluate the combined effects of those stresses, assuming they're independent, as they contribute to the time to failure of the system overall. So it's one system. Of course, though, the more stresses you apply, the more B factors or parameters that you're going to need to evaluate. So it's you don't want to go too many, as it'll probably overfit the problem and not be very accurate. It's like any model building in any regression assembly, is you want to have just enough to describe the vast majority of the variability, but not too many variables. And that takes some work in the regression side of the analysis. A proportional hazards model, it's also known by a Cox proportional hazards model, allows you to accumulate different sets of stresses or indicators that lead to a predictive model or a descriptive model, either one, of your time to failure distribution. Now, it makes no assumptions in building the model as what that distribution is going to be. So it could be anything, pretty much any kind of shape you want. But one of the results you get out of this is essentially a probability density function. But it doesn't have to be forced in to look like a normal distribution or a type of Weibull. But it does assume that the hazard rates for the various failure mechanisms are proportional to one another, so that the application of stress at one level is proportional according to the amount of stress at another level. And that each of the hazard rates and each of the failure mechanisms behave in that similar way, is that they don't have to have the same proportionality, but they do have to operate in that realm where they're well behaved over the region that we're expecting. And furthermore, is that the stresses have a multiplicative effect on the hazard rate. So if I add another stress, it's going to multiply its probability of failure against the other ones. Against the other failure rates or probability or reliability functions, so that I get my overall hazard rate when we run those calculations out. So it has some limitations in that regard, because I can't deal with nonlinearity or series curvature or interactions all that well. But it does let me deal with attribute data. For example, if I was doing some analysis for the drill head going in for oil exploration, and they had different classifications for rock formations. And they found that certain rocks had a much higher propensity to cause failures than other rock did. And so we just categorized those, and we had different names for the different rock formations. And we used that directly in the proportional hazards model. But it also deals with when you have a failure right at time zero, sensor data and tide values also. So it deals with models that are a bit more complex, that, say, a Weibull distribution with an Arrhenius equation is just not going to give you an adequate fit. And so it can deal with multiple input variables, and it can deal with attribute data, which is primarily why I used it in the past. Now there's also parametric models, and these are using distributions and lifetime time to failure distributions. And so we typically plot these on a cumulative distribution CDF type plot where it's 0.01 to 0.99, often on a log scale, but not necessarily, and time to failure. Again, if it's a Weibull distribution, this will be on a log-log plot. But I'll end up with some kind of line and maybe some data that supports that creation of that line. And what it basically is saying is that at some point in time, I've got some probability of failure cumulatively. And so at some other point in time, I have a higher probability of failure. So can it survive up to A? Well, that's probability A, say 0.05. Well, how about to B? Well, that's the probability of surviving to B, or probability of failing out to that point. I should reverse these. 1 minus this value is the probability of success or reliability. And so these curves allow us then to analyze data, say, at an accelerated test condition. And let's say we're using a relatively high temperature, say 100 degrees C, to accelerate some particular product. And we use the Arrhenius equation then to translate that to, say, 40 degrees C. And then it basically is shifting the entire curve to the use temperature, and it gives us a probability of failure when we should see the first percentile failure and when we should see all of them fail, which is much longer than at the higher stresses. Now, of course, assuming that our acceleration model accurately predicts this transition. So the parametric model is that this line is the time to failure distribution, and that the stress is accounted for with some acceleration model of some sort. So let me get rid of that. So one of those models, and we've mentioned this a few times, is the Arrhenius model, and it uses the nominal stress or the normal temperature that we operate at, or say the upper limit of the temperature range we operate at, the stress temperatures, the activation energy, which I'll mention again, is critical that you associate it with the failure mechanism's chemical reaction, if at all possible. And then Boltzmann's constant that fits into it. It's used quite a bit to deal with chemical rate reaction type equations, but it's also used as a very flexible model to fit all kinds of different data, especially primarily when you have temperatures being involved. So you'll see this model used quite often. There's also the Ehring model, and I think I've mentioned this one prior also, is that it allows you to deal with more than one stress factor. So I can have, and this is a more general form, I'm pretty sure I've talked about this before. It seems very familiar at the moment. But I could put in voltages and temperature, or I could have temperature and humidity. And it's really only, it's typically used to empirically fit to a whole pile of test data. So Peck's equation was looking at hundreds of different evaluations that ran out to time to failure and got some distribution data. And then they were able to model the different stresses and found that, say, temperature and humidity would fit it fairly well. And so study and some verification over the years has confirmed that it's a suitable model for many cases. Another very common model is the inverse power law model, or inverse power rule or model. I've seen it done both ways. But basically, it's a ratio with some exponent. That's the indicator of the power law. And I think some people quibble that this should be a negative sign for inverse power model and a plus sign on the exponent for just a power model. But either way, you get it. In this case, it's a voltage stress that we're applying. And I've seen it used a number of times for capacitors and voltage breakdown. But it's also used in a variety of other models and tools as a standard tool. In the Norris Landsberg equation, this term has frequency of cycling. So how often are the solder joints thermally cycled? And it has an exponent that's associated with just the ratio of frequencies of the cycling stress. But how do you know which model to use? And that's the million-dollar question. When completely in doubt and you don't have any decent model to use, well, build your own. And there's plenty of existing models out there to give you some indication of what possibly would work or what you need to look at. The work in the physics of failure is in the business of creating these models, so it's a good place to do some research is in the literature on physics of failure modeling. But in general, the model you select is going to create the final results. So does this product last 10 years with 98% reliability or not? And the model is a significant contributor to the error in that number. Now, there's also measurement error, and there's experimental error, and there's all kinds of other things. But if you use the wrong model, you're still going to get a number, but it will could mislead you if not done with care. So last step in this section is to take a look at acceleration factors.